Book 5. A Hand Upon the Fates. I have had visions of the future, and each and every one of them ends up in the same place. Don't ask me what it means. I already know. That's the problem with visions of the future. Emperor Kellenved. Chapter 14. Where is the meaning in this stride, foot following foot? Why must the land crawl so beneath us in our journey? All to take us to the place where we began so long ago, only to find it strange and unknown and unredeemed. Who has blazed this trail, and how weary must I become before the rain grows gentle and soft as tears on the brow? Until the valley unfolds into a river the sweet color of sand, and trees ribbon the sky overhead with dusty leaves. How weary must you become as you rattle the chains and drown in the banners of meaning and rueful portent? If I make you share my torment, foot following foot, know that this is my curse of the swallowed key and cruel desire, and when our blood mixes and drains in the grey earth, when the faces blur before our eyes in these last of last days, we shall turn about to see the path of years we have made, and wail at the absence of answers and the things left unseen. For this is life's legion of truth, so strange, so unknown, so unredeemed, and we cannot know what we will live until the journey is done. My beautiful legion, leave me to rest on the wayside as onward you march to the circling sun, where spin shadows tracing the eternal day. Raise stones to signal my passing, unmarked and mysterious, saying nothing of me, saying nothing at all. The legion is faceless and must ever remain so, as faceless as the sky. Skull's Lament, Anamandaris, Fisher Kel'Tath. White as bone, the butterflies formed a vast cloud overhead. Again and again their swirling mass dimmed the sun with a blessed gift of shadow that moments later broke apart, proving that curses hid in every gift, and that blessings could pass in the blink of an eye. An eye swarming with flies. Badal could feel and indeed see them clustering at the corners. She could feel them drinking her tears. She did not resent their need, and their frenzied crawl and buzz felt cool against her scorched cheeks. Those that crowded her mouth she ate when she could, the taste bitter when she crushed them, the wings like patches of dry skin, almost impossible to swallow. Since the shards had left, only the butterflies and the flies remained, and there was something pure in these last two forces. One white, the other black. Only the extremes remained. From the unyielding ground below to the hollow sky above, from the push of life to the pull of death, from the breath hiding within to the last to leave a fallen child. The flies fed upon the living, but the butterflies waited for the dead. There was nothing in between, nothing but this walking, the torn feet and the stains they left behind, the figures toppling and then stepped over. In her head, Badal was singing. She sensed the presence of others. Not those ahead of her or those behind her, but ghostly things, invisible eyes and veiled thoughts, an impatience, a harsh desire for judgment, as if the snake's very existence was an affront, to be ignored, denied, fled from. But she would not permit any to escape. They did not have to like what they saw. They did not have to like her at all. Or Rut, or Held, or Sadik, or any of the bare thousand still alive. They could rail at her thoughts, at the poetry she found in the heart of suffering, as if it had no meaning to them, no value, no truth. They could do all of that, still she would not let them go.
I am as true as anything you have ever seen, a dying child abandoned by the world, And I say this, there is nothing truer, nothing. Flee from me if you can. I promise I will haunt you. This is my only purpose now, the only one left to me. I am history made alive, holding on but failing. I am everything you would not think of, belly filled and thirst slaked. There in all your comforts, surrounded by faces you know and love. But hear me, heed my warning, history has claws.
Sadik still carried his hoard. He dragged it behind him, in a sack made of clothes no longer needed by anyone. His treasure trove, his things. What did he want with them? What meaning hid inside that sack? All those stupid bits, the shiny stones, the pieces of wood. And the way, with every dusk, when they could walk no further, he would take them all out to look at them. Why did that frighten her? Sometimes he would weep for no reason, and make fists as if to crush all his baubles into dust, and it was then that she realized that Sadik didn't know what they meant either. But he wouldn't leave them behind. That sack would be the death of him. She imagined the moment when he fell, this boy she would have liked for a brother, onto his knees, hands all entwined in the cloth sleeves, falling forward so that his face struck the ground. He'd tried to get back up, but he'd fail, and the flies would swarm him until he was no longer even visible, just a seething, glittering blackness, where Sadik had been. They'd eat his last breath, drink the last tears from his eyes, which now just stared, invade his open mouth to make it dry as a cave, a spider hole, and then the swarm would explode, rush away, seeking more of life's sweet water. And down would descend the butterflies, to strip away his skin, and the thing left, with its sack, would no longer be Sadik.
Sadik will be gone. Happy Sadik, peaceful Sadik, a ghost hovering, looking down at that sack. I would have words for him, for his passing. I would stand over him, looking down at all those fluttering wings so like leaves, and I would try, one more time, to make sense of the sack, a sack that killed him. And I would fail, making my words few, weak, a song of unknowing, all I have for my brother Sadik. When that time comes, I will know it is time for me to die too. When that time comes, I will give up.
And so she sang, a song of knowing, the most powerful song of all. They had a day left, maybe two.
Is this what I wanted? Every journey must end. Out here there is nothing but ends. No beginnings left. Out here I have nothing but claws. Badal.
The word was soft, like crumpled cloth, and she felt it brush her senses.
Rut. I can't do this any more. But you are Rut, the head of the snake, and Held, who is the tongue. No, I can't. I have gone blind.
She moved up alongside him, studied his old man's face.
They're swollen, she said. Closed up, Rut. It's to keep them safe, your eyes. But I can't see. There's nothing to see, Rut. I can't lead. For this, there is no one better. Badal, even the stones are gone. Just walk, Rut. The way is clear. For as far as I can see, it's clear.
He loosed a sob. The flies poured in, and he bent over, coughing, retching. He stumbled, and she caught him before he fell. Rut righted himself, clutching Held tight. Badal heard a soft whimper rising from them both.
No water. This is what is killing us now.
Squinting, she glanced back. Sadik was nowhere in sight. Had he already fallen? If he had, it would be just as well that she'd not seen it. Other faces, vaguely familiar, stared at her and Rut, waiting for the snake to begin moving once again. They stood hunched over, tottering. They stood with backs arched and bellies distended as if about to drop a baby. Their eyes were depthless pools where the flies gathered to drink. Sores crusted their noses, their mouths and ears. Skin on cheeks and chins had cracked open and glistened beneath ribbons of flies. Many were bald, missing teeth, their gums bleeding, and Rut was not alone in being blind.
"Our children, see what we have done to them. Our mothers and fathers left us to this, and now we leave them too in our turn. There is no end to the generations of the foolish. One after another, and at some point we all started nodding, thinking this is how it has to be, and so we don't even try to change things. All we pass down to our children is the same stupid grin. But I have claws, and I will tear away that grin. I swear it. Badal."
She had begun singing out loud, wordless, the tone low and then building, thickening, until she could feel more than one voice within her, and each in turn joined her song, filling the air. Their sound was one of horror, a terrible thing. She felt its power growing, growing.
"Adal, I have claws, I have claws. I have claws. Show me that grin one more time. Show it, I'm begging you. Let me tear it from your face. Let me rip deep until my talons score your teeth. Let me feel the blood and let me hear the meat splitting. And let me see the look in your eyes as you meet mine. Let me see I have claws, I have claws, I have claws. Badal!"
Someone struck her, knocked her down. Stunned, she stared up into Sadik's face, his round, wizened face. And from his eyes, red tears tracked down through the dust on his leathery cheeks.
"Don't cry," she whispered. "It's all right, Sadik. Don't cry."
Rut knelt beside her, groped with one hand until his fingers brushed her forehead.
"What have you done?"
His tone startled her.
"The cloth is torn. They're all too weak," she said. "Too weak to feel anger. So I felt it for them, for all of you."
She stopped. Rut's fingertips leaked blood. She could feel crystal shards digging into her back.
"What?" "You moved us,"
Sadik said.
"It hurt."
She could hear wailing now. The snake was writhing in pain.
I went looking. "For what?"
Rut demanded.
"For what?" "For claws."
Sadik shook his head.
"Badal, we're children. We don't have claws."
The sun dimmed then, and she squinted past Sadik. But the butterflies were gone.
"Flies. Look at all the flies. We don't have claws, Badal." "No, Sadik, you're right. We don't. But someone does."
The power of the song still clung to her, fierce as a promise.
"Someone does. I'm taking us there,"
she said, meeting Sadik's wide eyes. He drew back, leaving her to stare up at the sky. Flies roiling in a massive cloud, black as the abyss. She clambered to her feet.
"Take my hand, Rut. It's time to walk."
She crouched, staring up at the gate. Beneath it, the crumbling ruin of Kettle House was like a thing crushed under a heel. Something like blood oozed out from its roots to carve runnels down the slope. She believed it was dead, but of course there was no way to know for sure. There was no glory in failure. Killatha had learned that long, long ago. The passing of an age was always one of dissolution, a final sigh of exhaustion and surrender. She had seen her kin vanish from the world, the venal mockery that were the T'lani Mas hardly weighed as much as dust upon the scales of survival, and she well understood the secret desires of Olar Ithil. Maybe the hag would succeed. The spirits knew she was ripe for redemption. Killatha had lied, to Onrak, to Udinas, to Ulshun Pral and his clan. There had been no choice. To remain here would have seen them all slain, and she would not have that on her conscience. When the wound was breached, the Elaint would enter this world. There was no hope of stopping them. Tiam could not be denied, not with what was coming. The only unknown to her mind was the crippled god. The Forkrel assail was simple enough, as bound to the insanity of final arguments as were the Tist Leosan. Kin in spirit, those two. And she believed she knew what her brother intended to do, and she would leave him to it. And if her blessing meant anything, well, then he had it, with all her heart. No, the crippled god was the only force that troubled her. She remembered the earth's pain when he was brought down from the sky. She remembered his fury and his agony when first he was chained. But the gods were hardly done with him. They returned again and again, crushing him down, destroying his every attempt to find a place for himself. If he cried out for justice, no one was interested in listening. If he howled in wretched suffering, they but turned away. But the crippled god was not alone in that neglect. The mortal realm was crowded with those who were just as wounded, just as broken, just as forgotten. In this way, all that he had become, his very place in the pantheon, had been forged by the gods themselves. And now they feared him. Now they meant to kill him.
"Because the gods will not answer mortal suffering. It is too much work."
He must know what they intended. She was certain of it. He must be desperate in seeking a way out, an escape. No matter what, she knew he would not die without a fight. Was this not the meaning of suffering? Her feline eyes narrowed on the gate. Starvald Demolane was a fiery red welt in the sky, growing, deepening.
"Soon," she whispered.
She would flee before them. To remain here was too dangerous. The destruction they would bring to this world would beggar the dreams of even the Forkrel Asael. And once upon the mortal realm, so crowded with pathetic humans, there would be slaughter on a colossal scale. Who could oppose them? She smiled at the thought.
"There are a few, aren't there? But too few. No friends. Let them loose. Tiam must be reborn to face her most ancient enemy. Chaos against order, as simple, as banal as that. Do not stand in their path. Not one of you could hope to survive it."
What then of her children?
"Dear brother, let us see, shall we? The hag's heart is broken, and she will do whatever she can to see it healed. Despise her on us. The spirits know she deserves nothing else, but do not dismiss her. Do not."
It seemed very complicated. Kilava Onas looked up at the wound.
"But it isn't. It isn't anything like that at all."
Rock cracked in Kettle House, startling her. Reddish mists roiled out from the sundered walls.
"She was flawed, was Kettle. Too weak. Too young."
What legacy could be found in a child left alone, abandoned to the fates? How many truths hid in the scatter of small bones? Too many to bear thinking about. Another stone shattered, a sound like snapping chains. Kilava returned her attention to the gate. Gruntel slumped against a massive boulder in the full sun, and leaned his head back against the warm stone, closing his eyes.
"Instinct's a bitch."
The god who had damned him was a burning presence deep inside, filling him with an urgency he could not understand. His nerves were frayed. He was exhausted. He had journeyed through countless realms, desperate to find the quickest path to take him where?
"A gate. A disaster about to be unleashed. What is it you so fear, Trake? Why can you not just tell me, you miserable rat-chewing bastard? Show me an enemy. Show me someone I can kill for you, since that seems to be the only thing that pleases you."
The air stank. He listened to the flies crawling on the corpses surrounding him. He didn't know where he was. Broad-leafed trees encircled the glade. He had heard geese flying overhead, but this was not his world. It felt different, like a place twisted by sickness, and not the sickness that had taken the 20 or so wretched humans lying here in the high grasses, marring their skin with weeping pustules, swelling their throats and forcing their tongues past blistered lips. No, all of that was just a symptom of some deeper disease.
There was intention here. Someone summoned Polyel and set her upon these people. I am being shown true evil. Is that what you wanted, Drake? Reminding me of just how horrifying we can be. People curse you, and the pestilence of your touch ruins countless lives. But you are not a stranger to any world. These people, someone used you to kill them.
He thought he'd seen the worst of humanity's flaws back in Capustan, in the Panion War. An entire people deliberately driven insane. But if he understood the truths behind that war, there had been a wounded thing at the very core of the domain. A thing that could only lash out, claws bared, so vast, so consuming was its pain. And though he was not yet ready for it, a part of him understood that forgiveness was possible, from the streets of Capustan to the throne in Coral, and probably beyond. There had been mention of a being trapped in a gate, sealing a wound with its own life force. He could track an argument through all that, and the knowledge gave him something close to peace, enough to live with.
But not here. What crime did they commit, these poor people, to earn such punishment?
He could feel his tears drying on his cheeks.
This is unforgivable. Is it my anger you want, Drake? Is this why I am here, to be reawakened? Enough of the shame, the grief, the self-recrimination. Is that what you're telling me? Well then, it hasn't worked. All I see here is what we're capable of doing.
He missed Ganos Paran and Itkovian, friends to whom he could speak. They seemed to belong to a different life, a life long lost to him.
Harlow. Ah, you should see your namesake, my friend. Oh, how you would have loved him. She'd have to fight you off, brick up the doors to keep you from being his father. You'd have shown her what it meant to love a child unconditionally. Stonny, do you miss Harlow as much as I do? But you've got the boy, you've got your son, and I promised I would come back. I promised. What would you do here, Master of the Deck?
His question was swallowed by the glade.
What choice would you make, Paran? We weren't happy with our lots, were we? But we took hold of them anyway, by the throat. I expect you've yet to relinquish your grip. Me? Ah, gods, how I've messed it up.
In his dreams he had seen a blackened thing, with claws of red and fangs dripping gore, lying panting, dying, on churned-up earth. The air was brittle cold. The wind whipped about as if warring with itself. What place was that?
That place? Gods, it's where I'm going, isn't it? I have a fight ahead. A terrible fight. Is she my ally? My lover? Is she even real?
It was time. An end to these morbid thoughts, this brush with self-indulgence. He knew well that to give voice to certain feelings, to expose them in all their honesty, made him vulnerable to derision. Don't touch us with what you feel, we don't believe you. His eyes blinking open, he looked around. Crows on the branches, but even they were not yet ready to feed. Gruntled climbed to his feet, walked to the nearest corpse, a young man, skin of burnished bronze, braided hair black as pitch. dressed like some Reavy outlander. Stone tools, a wooden club at his waist, beautifully carved, shaped like a cutlass, the edge oiled and gleaming.
You loved that sword, didn't you? But it didn't help you. Not against this.
He turned, took in the glade, and spread his arms.
You died miserable. I now offer you something more, a second way.
The hair on the back of his neck lifted. Their spirits had drawn close.
You were warriors. Come with me and be warriors once again. And if we are to die, then it shall be a better death. I can offer this, but nothing more.
The last time he had done this, his followers had been alive. Until this moment, he had not even known that this was possible, this breaching of death's barrier.
It's all changing. I don't think I like it.
The spirits drifted back to their bodies, the flies scattered. Moments later, limbs twitched, mouths opened to dry rasps.
Now, Drake, we can't have them like this, can we? Heal their flesh, you piece of immortal dung.
Power filled the glade, an emanation that pushed back the vile curse of this realm, all the exultant expressions of evil that seemed to thrive unopposed in this place, swept away, refuted. He remembered sitting at a campfire, listening to Harlow going on about something, and a fragment of words returned to him now. The face across the fire, long and flickering.
War, Gruntle. Like it or not, it's the spur of civilization.
And then that lopsided grin.
Hear that, Drake? I just figured out why you've granted me this gift. It's all nothing but expedience with you. One hand blesses, but the other waits for the coin. And you'll be paid no matter what. No matter what.
21 silent warriors now faced him, their sores gone, their eyes bright. He could be cruel now and just take them.
He'll have made sure you could understand me. He'll have done that, I think.
Cautious nods.
Good. You can stay here. You can return to your people, if any are still alive. You can try to seek vengeance against the ones who killed you. But you know you'll lose. Against the evil now in your land, you are doomed. Your warriors, when you run with me, know that a fight awaits us. That is our path.
He hesitated and then spat to one side.
Is there glory in war? Come with me and let's find out.
When he set off, 21 warriors followed. And when he awakened his power, they rushed closer.
This, my friends, is called veering. And this, my friends, is the body of a tiger. A rather big one.
The three strangely garbed strangers they found walking on the trail ahead barely had time to lift their long clubs before Gruntle was among them. Once he passed, there wasn't much left of those three pale men, and he felt the pleasure of his companions, and shared it.
There's only one thing to do with evil. Take it in your jaws and crush it.
Then they were gone from the world. What place washes bones up like driftwood? Mappo's gaze narrowed on the flat, blinding stretch awaiting him. Shards of quartz and gypsum studded the colourless dead ground like knots of cacti. The horizon was level behind shimmering waves of heat, as if this desert reached to the very edge of the world.
I have to cross it.
He crouched, reached down and picked up a long bone, studied it.
Bedarin? Maybe. Not yet fully grown.
He collected another.
Wolf or dog jaw. So, this desert was once prairie. What happened?
The bones fell with a clatter. Straightening, Mappo drew a deep breath.
I think I am getting tired of living. Tired of the whole thing.
Nothing is working like it used to. Flaws are appearing, signs of things breaking down inside the very core of my spirit. But I have one thing left to do, just one thing left, and then I can be done with all this. He found himself drifting off, not for the first time, finding that place in his head where every thought rattled like chains, and he could only drag himself in crooked circles, the weight stealing his strength, his willingness to go on. One thing left. It's down to managing resources, harboring the will, navigating between all the sour truths. You can live that long, Mappo. You have no choice but to live that long, or all this will be for nothing. I see the world's edge waiting for me. He tightened the straps of his sack and then set out, at a steady jog. It's just a desert. I've run across a few in my day. I won't go hungry, I won't go thirsty, and whatever exhaustion comes to me, well, it'll end when it's all over. With each footfall, his nerves seemed to recoil from the contact. This was a damaged place, one vast scar upon the earth, and for all the death lining the desert's bizarre shore behind him, there was life here, inimical, unpleasant life, and it possessed intent. You feel me, don't you? I offend you. But it is not my desire to offend. Leave me to pass, friend, and we will be done with each other. Flies buzzed round him now. He had settled into a dog trot, his breathing steady and deep. The insects kept pace, gathering in ever greater numbers. Death is not punishment, it is release. I have seen that all my life. Though I did not wish to, though I told myself stories to pretend otherwise, every struggle must end. Is the rest that follows eternal? I doubt it. I doubt we'd ever get off that easily. Hood, I feel your absence. I wonder what it means. Who now waits beyond the gate? So much anguish comes in knowing that each of us must pass through it alone, to then discover that once through we remain alone. No, that is too much to bear. I could have married, stayed in the village. I could have fathered children and seen in each child something of my wife, something of me. Is that enough meaning to a life? A cloth of unending folds? I could have murdered Icarium, but then he has instincts for such things. His madness awakens so fast, so utterly fast, that I might have failed, and after killing me his rage would have sought a new target, and many others would have died. There really was no choice. There never was. Is it any wonder I am so tired? The flies swarmed him in a thick, glittering cloud. They sought out his eyes, but those had closed to slits. They spun round his mouth, but the gusts of breath from his nostrils drove them off. His people had been herders. They understood flies. He ignored their seething embrace. It meant nothing, and on he ran. But then my death would have made my loved ones grieve, and there's nothing pleasant in grieving. It is hot and dry to the touch. It is weakness taken inside. It can rise up and drown a life. No, I am glad I never found a wife, never fathered children. I could not bear to be the cause of their sorrow. How can one give so freely of love to another, when the final outcome is one of betrayal, when one must leave the other, to be the betrayer who dies, to be the betrayed left alive? How can this be an even exchange, with death waiting at the end? He ran, and time passed. The sun tracked across half the sky. The warm ache in his legs had shaken off the torment of his thoughts again and again, leading him into a world emptied of everything. How perfect is running, this grand delusion of flight, away from our demons, ever away, until even the self sobs loose, spins lost in our wake. Perfect, oh yes, and a thing to despise. No distance can win an escape, no speed can outrun this self and all its host of troubles. It's only the sweet exhaustion that follows that we so cherish. An exhaustion so pure, it is as close to dying as we can get without actually doing so. Poets could speak knowingly of metaphors. If life is walking, then running is a life's entire span speeded up, and to act out birth to death in a single day, over and over again, has the flavour of perfect habit, for it mimics undeniable truths. Small deaths paying homage to the real one. We choose them in myriad forms and delight in the ritual. I could run until I wear out, every joint, every bone and every muscle. I could run until my heart groans older than its years and finally bursts. I could damn the poets and make the metaphor real. We are all self-destructive. It is integral to our nature. And we will run even when there's nowhere to run to and nothing terrible to run from. Why? Because to walk is just as meaningless. It just takes longer. Through the screen of whizzing flies, he saw something in the sky ahead. A darker cloud, a towering, swirling thing. Dust storm? There was no dust. A whirlwind? Maybe. But the air was still. It was in his path, although still some distance away. He watched it to track its path. The cloud remained directly ahead. Just bigger. It's coming straight at me. More flies? The insects surrounding him were suddenly frenzied, and he caught something in their manic buzzing. You're part of this, aren't you? The finders of life, and once found you, summon. He could hear that cloud now, a deeper, more frightening drone quickly overwhelming the swarming flies. Locusts. But that makes no sense. There is nothing for them to eat. There is nothing here at all. All of this felt wrong. Mappo slowed his run, halted. The flies spun round him a moment longer and then fled. He stood, breathing deep, eyes on the vast spinning pillar of locusts. And then, all at once, he understood. Diverse. Something that looked like white foam was spreading from the base of the locust cloud, surging in tumultuous waves. Gods below. Butterflies. You're all diverse. You're all one thing, one creature. The flies, the locusts, the butterflies, and this desert is where you live. He recalled the bones upon the edge. This desert is what you made. The butterflies reached him, whipped round him, so many he could no longer see the ground at his feet. The frantic breaths of their wings stole the sweat from his skin until he began shivering. Diverse, I would speak to you. Semble, show yourself to me. The locusts blighted half the sky, devouring the sun, spinning overhead and then, in a wave of rage, descending. Mappo dropped to his knees, buried his face beneath his arms, hunched down. They struck his back like a deluge of darts. As more poured down, he grunted at their weight. Bones creaked. He struggled for breath, clenched his jaws against the pain. The locusts stabbed again and again with their jaws, driven mad by the feel and scent of living flesh. But he was Trell, and his kind had skin like leather. The locusts could not draw blood, but the weight grew vast, seeking to crush him. In the gap his arms made for his face, he stared at inky darkness, and his gasp snatched up dust from the ground. Deafened by the futile clack of bladed jaws, buried in riotous darkness, he held on. He could feel the mind of the diverse now. Its fury was not for him alone. Who stung you so? Who in this desert drove you away? Why are you fleeing? The being was ancient. It had not assembled in a long time, thousands of years, perhaps more. Lost now to the primitive instincts of the insects.
Shards, opals, diamonds, gems, leaves, drinkers.
The words slithered into him as if from nowhere, a girl's sing-song voice that now echoed in his mind.
Shards, opals, diamonds, gems, leaves, drinkers, go away.
With a deafening roar, the vast weight on Mappo's back burst apart, exploded outward. He sat up, tilted back his head.
Shards, opals, diamonds, gems, leaves, drinkers, go away! Go away! Go!
A song of banishing. The cloud heaved upward, twisted, and then churned past him. Another seething wave of butterflies, and then they too were gone. Stunned, Mappo looked round. He was alone.
Child, where are you? Such power in your song. Are you Forkrel Asael? No matter. Mappo thanks you.
He was covered in bruises. Every bone ached.
But still alive. Child, be careful. This diverse was once a god. Someone tore it apart into so many pieces it can never heal. It can't even find itself. All it knows now is hunger. Not for you or me, for something else. Life itself, perhaps. Child, your song has power. Be careful. What you banish, you can also summon.
He heard her voice again, fainter now, drifting away.
Like the flies, like the song of the flies.
Grunting, he climbed to his feet, drew his sack round and loosened the drawstrings, reached in and lifted out a water skin. He drank deep, sighed, drank a second time, and then stuffed the skin back into the sack. Tightening the shoulder straps again, he faced east and resumed running for the edge of the world.
Nice sword. Alas, this one I must use. I will give my two leathery swords to you.
Riad Elais leaned back against the knobby stone of the cave wall.
How did they get the dragons on that blade?
Silchas Ruin continued studying the weapon he had unsheathed. The flames of the hearth danced up and down its length.
There is something wrong with this, he said. The House of Hust burned to the ground with everything else. Not Carcanus itself, of course. That city didn't burn. Not precisely. But Hust, well, those forges were a prize, you see. And what could not be held had to be destroyed.
Riad glanced away at the pearl sky beyond the cave mouth. Another dawn had arrived. He'd been alone for some time, awakened to find that the Tist Andi had returned sometime in the night, blown in like a drift of snow.
I don't understand what you're saying.
The white face took on an almost human hue, bathed as it was in the firelight. But those red eyes were as unnerving as ever.
I thought I knew all the weapons forged by the Hust, even the obscure ones.
That one does not look obscure, Silchas, said Riad. It looks like a hero's weapon, a famous weapon, one with a name.
As you say, Silchas agreed, and I am not so old as to forget the ancient warning about trusting shadows. No, the one who gave me this sword is playing a game.
Someone gave it to you? In return for what?
I wish I knew.
Riad smiled.
Never bargain, knowing only the value of one side of the deal. Onrak said that to me once, or maybe it was Ulshun Pral.
Silchas shot him a look. Riad shrugged, lifting himself to his feet.
Do we now resume our journey?
Sheathing the sword, Silchas straightened as well.
We have gone far enough, I think.
What do you mean?
I needed to take you away from Starvald Demelaine, and now I have done so.
He faced Riad.
This is what you must learn. The Elaint blood within you is a poison. I share it, of course. My brother and I chose it for ourselves. We perceived a necessity, but that is the fatal lure of power, isn't it? With the blood of Tiam within our veins, we could bring peace to Curald Galain. Of course, that meant crushing every house opposing us.
Regrettable, but that sentiment was as far as the poison would permit us to go in our thoughts. The thousands who died could not make us hesitate, could not stop us from continuing, killing thousands more. I am not you, Silchas Ruin. Nor will you ever be, if I can help it. Riad walked to the cave's edge, looked out on bleak, jagged rock and blinding sweeps of snow where the sun's light marched down into the valley below. Elsewhere, in shadow, the snow was as blue as the sky. What have you done, Silchas? Behind him, the Tist Andi replied,
What I deemed necessary. I have no doubt that Kilava succeeded in forcing your people out of that realm. They won't die, not there, not then. Udinas is a clever man. In his life, he has come to understand the pragmatism of survival. He will have led the Imas away from there, and he will find them a home, somewhere to hide from humans.
How? Riad demanded. It's not even possible.
He will seek help.
Who?
Seren Pedak. Silchas replied. Her old profession makes her a good choice.
Her child must have been born by now.
Yes, a child she knows she must protect. When Udinas comes to her, she will see how her need and his can be resolved together. She will guide the Imas to a hidden place, and in that place she too will hide with her child. Protected by Onrak, protected by the Imas.
Why can't we be just left alone?
Riad heard the anguish in his own voice and closed his eyes against the outside glare.
Riad Elais, there is a kind of fish living in rivers that when in small numbers, two or perhaps three, is peaceful enough. But when the school grows, when a certain threshold is reached, these fish go mad. They tear things apart. They can devour the life in a river for a league's length, and only when their bellies start bursting do they finally scatter.
What has that to do with anything?
Riad turned to glare at Silchas Ruin. The Tist Andi sighed.
When the gate of Starvald Demelane opens, the Elaint will come through in vast numbers. Most will be young, by themselves little threat, but among them there will be the last of the ancients, leviathans of appalling power. But they are incomplete. They will arrive hunting their kin. Riad, if you and I had remained, seeking to oppose the opening of that gate, we would lose our minds. We would, in mindless desire, join the storm of the Elaint. We would follow the ancients. Have you never wondered why, in all the realms but Starvald Demelane itself, one will never find more than 5 or 6 dragons in one place? Even that many demands the mastery of at least one ancient. Indeed, to be safe, Elaint tend to travel in threes.
Silchas Ruin walked up to stand beside Riad and stared out at the vista.
We are the blood of chaos, Riad Elais. And when too many of us gather in one place, the blood boils.
Then, Riad whispered, the Elaint are coming, and there's no stopping them.
What you say is true, but here you are safe.
Me? What of you?
Silchas Ruin's hand found the grip of his scabbarded sword.
I must leave you now, I think. I did not plan it, and I am not pleased at the thought of abandoning you.
And all that we spoke of before was a lie, cut in Riad. Our perilous mission, all of it, a lie.
Your father understood. I promised him that I would save you, and I have done so.
Why did you bother?
Because you are dangerous enough alone, Riad. In a storm, no, I could not risk that.
Then you intend to fight them after all?
I will defend my freedom, Riad.
What makes you think you can, with what you said of the ancients?
Because I am one, Riad. An ancient.
Riad stared at the tall, white-skinned warrior.
Could you compel me, Silchas Ruin?
I have no desire to even so much as attempt it, Riad. Chaos seduces. You have felt it, and soon you may witness the fullest expression of that curse. But I have learned to resist the seduction.
He smiled suddenly, and in an ironic tone added,
We, Tist Andi, are skilled at denying ourselves. We have had a long time to get it right, after all.
Riad drew his furs close about himself. His breath plumed in the bitter cold. He concentrated a moment, was answered by a billowing of the hearth's flames behind him. Heat roiled past. Silchas glanced back at the sudden inferno.
You are indeed your mother's son, Riad.
He shrugged.
I was tired of being chilled.
He then looked across at Silchas.
Was she an ancient Elaint?
The first few generations of Soul-Taken count among the ancients, yes. Tiam's blood was at its purest then, but that purity is short-lived.
Are there others like you, Silchas, in this world?
Ancients?
He hesitated and then nodded.
A few.
When the storm arrives, what will they do?
I don't know. But we who were not trapped within Starvald Demolaine all share our desire for independence, for our freedom.
So they will fight like you?
Perhaps.
Then why can I not fight beside you?
If I must defend you while defending myself, well, it is likely that I would fail on both counts.
But I am Menandor's son.
And formidable, yes. But you lack control. An ancient will see you, will see all that you are, and it will take you, tearing out your mind and enslaving what remains.
If you did the same to me, imagine how powerful you would then be, Silchas.
Now you know why dragons so often betray one another in the heat of battle. It is our fear that makes us strike at our allies before they can strike at us. Even in the storm, the ancients will trust not one of their equals, and each will possess scores of lesser slaves as protection against betrayal.
It seems a terrible way to live.
You don't understand. It is not simply that we are the blood of chaos. It is that we are eager to boil. The Elaint revel in anarchy, in toppling regimes among the towers, in unmitigated slaughter of the vanquished and the innocent. To see flames on the horizon, to see the Enkarl vultures descending upon a corpse-strewn plain, this charges our heart as does nothing else.
The storm will unleash all that on this world?
Silchas Ruin nodded.
But who can stop them?
My other swords are beside your palate, Riad Elais. They are honorable weapons, if somewhat irritating on occasion.
Who can stop them?
We'll see.
How long must I wait here?
Silchas Ruin met his eyes with a steady reptilian stare.
Until the moment you realize that it's time to leave. Be well, Riad. Perhaps we will meet again. When next you see your father, do tell him I did what I promised.
He hesitated and then added,
Tell him, too, that with Kettle, I believe now that I acted hastily, and for that I am sorry.
Is it Olar Ethil?
Silchas Ruin frowned.
What?
Is she the one you're going to kill, Silchas Ruin?
Why would I do that?
For what she said.
She spoke the truth, Riad.
She hurt you on purpose.
He shrugged.
What of it? Only words, Riad. Only words.
The Tistandi leaned forward then over the cliff's edge and slipped out of sight. A moment later he lifted back into view a bone-white dragon, white as the snow below, where his winged shadow slipped in pursuit. Riad stood a moment longer and then turned away from the cave mouth. The fire blazed until the sword started singing in the heat.
Look at you, squatting in your own filth like that. What happened to Fen's great pride? Wasn't that his name, Fen? That Teblor war king? So he died, friend. Doesn't mean you have to fall so low. It's disgusting, is what it is. Head back into the mountains. Oh, hold on a moment there. Let's see that mace. Take the sheath off, will you?
He licked chapped, stinging lips. His whole mouth felt swollen on the inside. He needed a drink, but the post's gate had been locked. He'd slept against it through the night, listening to the singing in the tavern.
Show it to me, Teblor. Could be we can make us a deal here.
He straightened up as best he could.
I cannot yield this, he said. It is an Elaintar Alketh, with a secret name. I walked the roads of the dead to win this weapon. With my own hands I broke the neck of a Fokral Asael.
But the guard was laughing.
Meaning it's worth 4 crowns, not 2, right? Harrower's breath, you people can spin 'em, can't you? Been through Death's Gate, have you? And back out again. Quite a feat for a drunk Teblor stinking of pig shit.
I was not always this way.
Of course not, friend. But here you are now, desperate for drink, with just me standing between you and the tavern. This could be Death's Gate all over again, come to think of it, eh? 'Cause if I let you through, why, the next time you leave, it'll probably be by the heels. You want through, Teblor? Gotta pay the harrower's coin. That mace. Hand it over, then.
I cannot. You don't understand. When I came back, you cannot imagine. I had seen where we all ended up, you see. When I came back, the drink called me. Helps me forget. Helps me hide. What I saw broke me, that's all. Please, you can see that, how it broke me. I'm begging.
Factor don't take to beggars, not here. You got nothing to pay your way in? Be off. Back into the woods. Dry as a hag's cubbyhole, true enough. Now, for that mace, well, I'll give you 3 crowns. Even you couldn't drink 3 crowns worth in a single night. 3. See? Got 'em right here. What do you say?
Father?
Get lost, lad. Me and your da's working out a business transaction here.
No deal, guard. Not for that weapon.
It's your da's to do with as he pleases.
You can't even lift it.
Wasn't planning on lifting it. But up on the wall of my brother's tavern, well, that'd make quite a sight, don't you think? Pride of place for you, Teblor, right over the hearth.
Sorry, sir. I'm taking him back to the village now.
Until tomorrow night, or next week. Listen, lad, you can't save them that won't be saved.
I know, but the dragon killer, that I can save.
Dragon killer? Old name. Too bad dragons don't exist.
Son, I wasn't going to sell it. I swear that.
I heard, Father. I wasn't. The elders have agreed, Father. The resting stone waits.
It does? Hey now, you two. Boy, did you say resting stone?
Best you pretend you never heard that, sir.
That vicious shit's outlawed. King's command. You, da. Your son says the elders are going to murder you under a big fucking boulder. You can claim sanctuary.
Sir, if you take him inside the fort, we will have no choice.
No choice? No choice but to do what?
It's better if none of this ever happened, sir.
I'm calling the captain.
If you do that, this will all come out. Sir, do you want to start the Teblor on the path to war? Do you want us to burn your fledgling colony to the ground? Do you want us to hunt down and kill every one of you? Children, mothers, the old and wise? What will the First Empire think of a colony gone silent? Will they cross the ocean to investigate? And the next time your people come to our shore, will we meet you not as friends but as enemies?
Son, bury the weapon with me, and the armor, please.
The youth nodded.
Yes, father.
This time when I die, I shall not return.
That is true.
Live long, son, as long as you can.
I shall try. Guard,
get out of my sight, both of you.
On to the forest trail, away from the trading post, the place where Teblor came down to surrender everything, beginning with dignity. He held his son's hand and did not look back.
There is nowhere to drink in the realm of the dead.
I am sorry, father.
I'm not, my son. I'm not.
Ublala sat up, wiping at his eyes.
They killed me! Again!
Ralata stirred beside him, twisting to lift her head and study him with bleary eyes. A moment later, her head disappeared again beneath the furs. Ublala looked round, found Draconis standing nearby, but the warrior's attention remained fixed on the eastern horizon, where the sun's newborn light slowly revealed a rocky, glittering desert. Rubbing at his face, the giant stood.
I'm hungry, Draconis. I'm chilled. My feet hurt. I got dirt under my nails and there's things living in my hair. But the sexing was great.
Draconis glanced over.
I had begun to doubt she would relent, Toblakai.
She was bored, you see. Boredom's a good reason, don't you think? I think so. I'll do more of that from now on with women I want to sex.
One brow arched.
You will bore them into submission, Ublala?
I will. Soon as we find more women, I'll bore them right to the ground. Was that a dragon you turned into? It was hard to see. You were all blurry and black like smoke. Can you do that whenever you like? You gods got it good, I think, being able to do things like that. Hey, where did that fire come from?
Best begin cooking your breakfast, Ublala. We have far to walk today, and it will be through a warren, for I like not the look of that desert ahead.
Ublala scratched his itchy scalp.
If you could fly, why don't you just go where you're going? Me and my wife, we can find someplace else to go. And I can bury the mace and the armor right here. I don't like them. I don't like the dreams they give me.
I will indeed leave you, Ublala, but not quite yet. As for the weapons, I fear you will need them soon. You will have to trust me in this, friend.
All right. I'll make breakfast now. Is that half a pig? Where's the other half? I always wonder that, you know, when I'm in the market and I see half a pig. Where's the other half? Did it run away? Ralata, did you hear me make a joke? As if half pigs can run. No, they'd have to kind of hop, wouldn't they? Hop, hop, hop.
From under the furs, Ralata groaned.
Ublala.
Yes, Draconis.
Do you believe in justice?
What? Did I do something wrong? What did I do? I won't make jokes no more, I promise.
You've done nothing wrong. Do you know when something is unfair? Ublala looked round desperately. Not at this moment, friend. I mean in general. When you see something that is unjust, that is unfair, do you do something about it? Or do you just turn away? I think I know the answer, but I need to make certain.
I don't like bad things, Draconis, Ublala muttered. I tried telling that to the Toblakai gods when they were coming up out of the ground, but they didn't listen. So me and Iron Bars, we had to kill them.
Draconis studied him for some time, and then he said, I believe I have just done something similar. Don't bury your weapons, Ublala. He had left his tent well before dusk to walk the length of the column among the restless soldiers. They slept badly or not at all, and more than one set of red-shot, bleary eyes tracked Ruthen Gud as he made his way to the rear. Thirst was a spreading plague, and it grew in the mind like a fever. It pushed away normal thoughts, stretching out time until it snapped. Of all the tortures devised to break people, not one came close to thirst. Among the wagons now, where heaps of dried, smoked meats remained wrapped in hides, stacked in the beds. The long knotted ropes with rigged harnesses were coiled up in front of each wagon. The oxen were gone. Muscle came from humans now, carrying food no one wanted to eat. Food that knotted solid in the gut. Food that gripped hard with vicious cramps and drove strong men to their knees. Next on the trail were the ambulance wagons, burdened with the broken, the ones driven half mad by sun and dehydration. He saw the knots of fully armed guards standing over the water barrels used by the healers, and the sight distressed him. Discipline was fraying, and he well understood what he was seeing. Simple need had the power to crush entire civilizations, to bring down all order in human affairs,
to reduce us to mindless beasts. And now it stalks this camp, these soldiers.
This army was close to shattering. The thirst gnawed ceaselessly. The sun cut a slice on the western horizon, red as a bloodless wound. Soon the infernal flies would stir awake, at first drowsy in the unwelcome chill, and then rushing in to dance on every exposed area of skin, as if the night itself had awakened with 100,000 legs. And then would come the billowing clouds of butterflies, keeping pace overhead like silver clouds tinted jade green. They had first arrived to feed on the carcasses of the last slaughtered oxen, and now they returned each evening, eager for more. He walked between the wagons with their moaning cargo, exchanging occasional nods with the cutters who moved among their charges with moistened cloths to press against blistered mouths. No pickets waited beyond the refuse trench. There seemed to be little point in such things, only a row of grave mounds, with a crew of a dozen diggers working on a few more with picks and shovels. Beneath the ground's sun-baked surface there was nothing but stone-hard white silts, deep as a man was tall. At times, when the pick broke a chunk loose, the pressed bones of fish were revealed, of types no one had ever seen before. Ruthen Gud had chanced to see one example. Some massively jawed monstrosity was etched in rust-red bones on a slab of powdery silt, enormous eye sockets above rows upon rows of long fangs. He'd listened to the listless conjecture for a short time, and then wandered on without adding any comment of his own. From the deepest ocean beds, he could have told them, but that would have slung too many questions his way, ones he had no desire to answer.
How the fuck do you know that?
Good question.
No, bad question.
He'd kept silent. Out past the diggers now, ignoring them as they straightened to lean on shovels and stare at him. He walked on to the trail the column had made, a road of sorts where the sharp stones had been kicked clear by the passage of thousands of boots. 20 paces, 30, well away from the camp now. He halted.
All right, then. Show yourselves.
He waited, fingers combing through his beard, expecting to see the dust swirl up from the path, lift into the air, find shape. The simple act of setting eyes upon a Tlani Mas depressed Ruthengard. There was shame in making the wrong choice. Only a fool would deny that. And just as one had to live with the choice, so too was one forced to live with the shame. Well, perhaps live wasn't the right word, not with the Tlani Mas.
Poor fools. Make yourselves the servants of war. Surrender everything else. Bury your memories. Pretend that the choice was a noble one, and that this wretched existence is good enough. Since when did vengeance answer anything? Anything of worth? I know all about punishment, retribution. Wish I didn't, but I do. It all comes down to eliminating that which offends. As if one could empty the world of bastards or scour it clean of evil acts. Well, that would be nice. Too bad it never works. And all that satisfaction, well, it proves short-lived, tasting like dust.
No poet could find a more powerful symbol of futility than the Tlani Mas. Futility and obstinate stupidity. In war, you need something to fight for. But you took that away, didn't you? All that you fought to preserve had ceased to exist. You condemned your entire world to oblivion, extinction. Leaving what? What shining purpose to drive you on and on? Oh yes, I remember now. Vengeance. No swirls of dust, just two figures emerging from the lurid, dust-wreathed west, shambling on the trail of the bone hunters. The male was huge, battered, hulking. His stone sword, carried loosely in one hand, was black with sun-baked blood. The female was more gracile than most Tlani Mas, dressed in rotted sealskins, and on her shoulder a small forest of wood, bone, and ivory harpoons. The two figures halted 5 paces from Ruthengard. The male bowed his head.
Elder, we greet you.
Ruthen scowled.
How many more of you are out there?
I am Kalt Urmanal, and the bone caster at my side is Nom Kala of the Brold. The two of us are all that are here. We are deserters.
Are you now? Well, among the bone hunters, desertion is punishable by death. Tell me, since that obviously won't work, how do the Tlani Mas punish deserters, Kalt?
They don't, Elder. Deserting is punishment enough.
Sighing, Ruthengard looked away.
Who leads the Tlani Mas army, Kalt? The army you fled?
The female, Nom Kala, answered.
Fast sword, Onos Tulan. Elder, there is the smell of ice about you. Are you Jagat?
Jagat? No. Do I look like a Jagat?
I do not know. I have never seen one.
Never what? I haven't washed in some time, Nom Kala.
He combed his beard.
Why did you follow us? What do you want with the bone hunters? No, wait. Let us return to that later. You say that Onos Tulan, the first sword, leads an army of Tlani Mas. Which clans? How many bone casters? Do they walk this same desert? How far away?
Kalt Urmanal said, far to the south, Elder. Of bone casters there are few, but of warriors there are many. Forgotten clans, remnants of armies broken on this continent in ancient conflicts. Onos Tulan summoned them.
No, said Nom Kala. The summons came from Olar Ethil in the making of Onos...
Shit!
Ruthen swore. Both Tlani Mas fell silent.
This is turning into a real mess.
Ruthen clawed again at his beard, glared at the undead warriors.
What is she planning, do you know?
She intends to wield the first sword, Elder,
Nom Kala replied.
She seeks redemption.
She has said this to you, Bonecaster?
No, Elder, she has not. She remains distant from Onos Tulan. For now,
But I was born on this soil. She cannot walk it with impunity, nor hide the power of her desires. She journeys eastward, parallel with Onos Tulan. Nomkala hesitated and then added, The First Sword is also aware of her, but he remains defiant.
He is a child slayer, Elder, said Kaltur Manau. A black river has drowned his mind, and those who chose to follow him can no longer escape its terrible current. We do not know the First Sword's intent. We do not know the enemy he will choose, but he seeks annihilation. Theirs or his own, he cares not how the bones will fall. What has driven him to such a state? Ruthengard asked, chilled by the warrior's words.
She has, Nomkala replied.
Does he know that?
He does, Elder.
Then could Olarethil be the enemy he chooses?
Both Tlanimas were silent for a moment, and then Kaltur Manal said,
We had not considered that possibility.
It seems she betrayed him, Ruthen observed. Why shouldn't he return the fever?